KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump has talked of not defending NATO allies if they don't pay. We hear from NATO's Secretary General, who says Trump is being even-handed in negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. FBI agents arrested a Milwaukee judge accused of helping a man in her court avoid immigration agents. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. What are locals saying about the charges against her? Also, why universities are so dependent on federal research funding, and Chubby Checker twists his way into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It is Monday, April 28th. On this day in 1967, Muhammad Ali refused to join the army over religious objections. The Supreme Court eventually overturned his criminal conviction. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. As President Trump's 100th day in office approaches, the White House is emphasizing his actions combating illegal immigration. As NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports, today the White House said, going forward, state and local law enforcement will be a key part of deportations.
At a briefing, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt addressed last week's Immigration and Customs Enforcement operation in Florida, Operation Tidal Wave. She said it resulted in the arrests of nearly 800 people in the U.S. illegally.
Operation Tidal Wave is a preview of what is to come around this country. Large-scale operations that employ our state and local enforcement partners to get criminal illegal aliens off our streets.
Today, Trump is expected to sign two executive actions related to border security, including one that will target sanctuary cities, jurisdictions with laws that limit cooperation with immigration authorities. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
Russia says it will observe a three-day ceasefire in its war with Ukraine. This will run May 8th through May 10th. The Kremlin says this will mark the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. This comes as North Korea is acknowledging it deployed troops to Russia to help Russian troops fight in Ukraine. NPR's Charles Maines reports from Moscow.
North Korea merely confirmed what South Korean and Western intelligence services have long said. Pyongyang secretly deployed soldiers to Russia beginning last fall to drive out Ukrainian troops from Russia's Kursk region. Russia only acknowledged the North Korean military assistance this past weekend when the head of Russia's armed forces thanked the North Koreans for help in fully liberating the territory. Kyiv and pro-Russian military bloggers insist Ukrainian forces are still operating in the area. Yet in a statement, Putin said Russia would never forget North Korean heroes who lost their lives in defense of Kursk, adding a bond forged with North Korea on the battlefield was bound to develop further. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
The U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case with important consequences for children with disabilities. The question before the justices is this: what do parents have to prove when a school district refuses to provide needed services for a child with serious disabilities? NPR's Christina Gatti reports.
Ava Tharp is a teenage girl who suffers from serious disabilities caused by a rare form of epilepsy. She has so many seizures in the morning hours that her public school in Kentucky arranged her schedule to be in the afternoon only, including giving her instruction at home in the early evening. But when her family moved to Minnesota, her new school refused to accommodate her late day schedule, and her learning hours were reduced to 65% of what her peers received. Ava's parents sued the school system, claiming that it failed to live up to the requirements specified under three different disability rights laws enacted by Congress. Now the Supreme Court will decide. Christina Gatti, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 140 points. You're listening to NPR News. The National Weather Service says it's going to resume some common translation services of its products. All this should be working by the end of the day. The translations were paused because a contract with an artificial intelligence company had lapsed. Forecasters had warned it could make it harder for people to get warnings during extreme weather events. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has announced its class of 2025. The inductees come from British rock and hip-hop. From IdeaStream Public Media, Kabir Bhatia reports they also include one long-standing omission.
Come on, baby. Let's do the twist.
He once protested the inductions, but now Chubby Checker will be welcomed into the Rock Hall. The man who touched off the 1960s twist craze with his string of hits has been eligible since the 1980s. He's joined this year by 70s hard rockers Bad Company and the late Joe Cocker, whose nomination this year was supported by Paul McCartney. More recent acts joining the Rock Hall this year are Outkast, Soundgarden, and the White Stripes. In the musical influence category, both singer-songwriter Warren Zevon and hip-hop pioneer Salt-N-Pepa made the cut this year. The inductions are November 8th in Los Angeles. For NPR News, I'm Kabir Bhatia in Cleveland.
Media reports in Japan say a college student has now been rescued from Mount Fuji twice in 1 week. The student had climbed Japan's tallest peak last Tuesday. He had to be rescued after he lost some equipment. He went back on Saturday to get his cell phone and other personal items. He then had to be rescued again after falling ill. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, we hear a defender of the Wisconsin judge accused of helping a man evade immigration authorities.
But first, Russia has announced a three-day ceasefire in Ukraine starting May 8th, when Russia celebrates a national holiday. The announcement comes as the Trump administration says it is still trying to reach a peace deal more than 3 years since Russia's full-on war on Ukraine began. The Trump team's proposal would apparently include Ukraine giving up Crimea, a territory that Russia illegally annexed years ago. But that's a concession that Ukraine has been unwilling to accept. When I spoke earlier with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, he suggested a middle way.
There is a difference between acknowledging, stating the fact that part of our country, in case of the Ukrainians, has been captured, in this case by the Russians, and saying now legally they own this. So we really have to make sure that we make that distinction.
Rutte was in Washington last week meeting with President Trump and other top diplomatic and security officials in advance of the annual summit in June for NATO, the world's biggest military alliance. I spoke with him as he was traveling between meetings, and I asked him how they were going, as America seeks to dial back its involvement in many international conflicts.
Yes, we discussed first Ukraine. I think we can all be very happy for the fact that President Trump broke the deadlock and started the talks. And obviously, it is the U.S. and U.S. leadership and Trump's leadership which we need here to bring this to a good end, and including the help from Secretary Hegseth Rubio and Security Advisor Walz. So we discussed the state of play on that. I think they're really making progress. The ball is now clearly in Russian's court. So they need to now make proposals, at least react to what is on the table. And we discussed the upcoming NATO summit, which I believe we have every reason to think will be very successful. So much more defense spending, particularly on the European and Canadian side, which is necessary, but also ramping up defense industrial production.
Well, as you just mentioned, in a couple of months, you're going to chair a summit of NATO nations in the Netherlands. You said you believe it will be successful. What does success look like?
For two reasons, I think it will be successful. First of all, because I believe we will decide that the European side of NATO and the Canadian side of NATO will ramp up spending, which is crucial because of the Russian threat, because of the Chinese build-up of its military, but also because it is fair to spend more on that side of NATO because it equalizes with what the US is spending. And rightly, the US has complained, and particularly President Trump has been very clear on this, that he expects the Europeans and Canada to pay more, to step up in terms of their overall defense spending. And that is going to happen. So that will be successful. And then there is an issue around, for the whole of NATO, including the US, that we do not produce enough in terms of defense industrial products. Ammunition, Navy ships, tanks, fighter jets, long-range missiles, and air defense systems, what have you. And we will take decisions in June to make sure that we will stay ahead of the Russians and the Chinese. And that is important to keep ourselves safe.
Turning to some specific conflicts, though, there are European leaders, both publicly and privately, have expressed some shock at what seems to be an American tilt toward Russia in these negotiations over the war, which it started in Ukraine, seem to be pressing Ukraine to make concessions, even as by some lights that the U.S. in the current administration doesn't seem to be pressing Russia as hard. Is that your view as well?
It is not. No, I think the U.S. is really trying to, and President Trump's team and he himself really try to, in an even-handed way, bring this whole process forward. It will mean compromises on all sides. What we have seen last, the attack on Kyiv, a residential area, people just going about their lives, 12 people killed, because of an indiscriminate attack by the Russians on that part of Kyiv. But also I was in Odessa the other week with President Zelensky, and I've seen the devastation there when attacks take place and these missiles come in this beautiful city. This is not a sign of strength by the Russians. If they really are winning this, they would not do this. It is clearly a sign of the weakness on the Russian side.
Ukraine's desire to seek NATO membership is a part of these discussions. Is that officially off the table now, to your understanding, or is that still part of the discussion?
No, there is a clear statement by NATO that there is an irreversible path for Ukraine into NATO, but we always knew that there were different views among allies. NATO is very much involved in building up the Ukrainian armed forces, helping with making sure that all the support for Ukraine, military support for Ukraine, is well coordinated. When it comes to full NATO membership, we never promised Ukraine that will be part of a peace deal.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth back in February warned that the U.S. is increasingly focused on Asia and its own borders for security. Did you walk away from this meeting feeling confident that the United States is still committed to NATO, even if it sort of reorders its priorities?
100% on both issues. One, the membership of NATO and a total commitment to Article 5. I was 4 weeks ago also visiting President Trump in the White House, and he was very clear on this. Obviously, the U.S. has to take care of more issues than only Europe and the Euro-Atlantic. There's also the Middle East. There's also the Indo-Pacific. So whilst the Europeans are stepping up, spending more, making sure that we can deliver more of the overall capabilities we need to deliver as NATO as a whole, that it's only logical for the US to pivot more towards Asia. But I'm absolutely convinced we will do this in a step-by-step approach. But it's only logical. Everybody understands that.
That is NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Mr. Secretary General, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Trump administration officials say nobody is above the law, which is why they say the FBI arrested a Wisconsin judge. They accused Milwaukee County Circuit Judge Hannah Dugan of ushering a person without legal status out of a side exit of her courtroom to evade immigration agents who wanted to arrest him. The man was charged with domestic violence at the time. That's why he was in court. Dugan has been released until her next court hearing, but hundreds of protesters have been demonstrating outside the FBI building in Milwaukee, and one of them is on the line, Ryan Clancy, who is a Democratic member of the State Assembly. Mr. Clancy, welcome to the program.
Steve, thanks so much for having me and covering this.
Granting that you're not a witness, you're gathering information from the media or whatever, like the rest of us, do you agree on the basic facts of what seems to have happened here, that there's a Mexican migrant in her court that ICE agents ask for him, that Judge Dugan gets upset about this and lets him out the side door.
I think some of those facts are in dispute, and I think there's a significant difference here between an administrative warrant, which is what ICE said and admitted that they have in their complaint, which is essentially an internal document, and an actual warrant signed by an actual judge. And I'm very grateful that Judge Dugan recognized the difference and acted accordingly. She just stood up for our community here.
Oh, now this is very interesting, because you could imagine the judge saying, well, the judge has an obligation to cooperate with the law enforcement authorities, the federal authorities who appear in front of her. But you're saying that, you're arguing that they may have had less than full authority to demand full cooperation from the judge?
Absolutely. They did not have a real warrant signed by a real judge. Essentially, an administrative warrant from ICE is a piece of paper that they produce themselves saying they can do what they want. It doesn't have the same power as an actual warrant does. And Judge Dugan, as a judge herself, apparently realized that and did what I hope any of us would do, which is standing up for members of our community who are being targeted by the Trump regime.
Didn't work out for him. I mean, the authorities chased the guy down after he went out the side door, and they arrested him anyway.
They did, and that is it has a really profound and negative chilling effect. Courthouses and courtrooms specifically have been protected spaces, just like operating rooms, classrooms. You don't want law enforcement, you don't want ICE specifically operating without impunity in those areas. And my concern here, and we've already started to see this, is that people who would normally be willingly participating in the justice system are now, you know, going to think twice if they think that, you know, showing up either as a defendant or a witness may lead to their own arrest.
Can you tell me, though, what ICE should have done? They have this federal policy to deport people. That is also the law, that people who are not here legally should not be here legally. They are supposed to get this guy. What should they have done? Should they have just left him in the courthouse? Should they have ignored him, tried to find him somewhere else? What should they have done?
Certainly. I mean, I do not think that ICE should be deporting people at all. We have done without ICE for many years. And even prior to that, there's been a longstanding tradition for good reason of not going into those safe, protected spaces. So we can debate whether or not ICE should be deporting people at all. They should not. ICE should be abolished. That said, they absolutely should not be going into courtrooms. That has a chilling effect both on people that are there to participate and also elected and appointed officials like judges who are clearly being targeted by this administration as well.
I want to make sure that I understand what you're telling me. You're not saying ICE should not be deporting people from courts, which is a point of view. You're saying ICE should not be deporting people? Just anybody should come here for any reason and nobody should enforce the law?
That's a larger issue. I mean, certainly we do not have significant legal pathways for folks who want to do the right thing and want to be here and join our American society in the right way. And it is frustrating for people to hear, you know, oh, they should be doing it the right way. There are many, many people who are integrated into our communities, who are part of our communities, who are trying to do the right thing and are trying to get legal status. Despite the fact that we make it really difficult at the federal level, we should not be deporting those people either. And to be very clear, ICE should not exist. ICE should be abolished.
Understand your point of view there. Like, getting back to the judge now, are you concerned about where this is going with a judge being arrested given these circumstances?
Absolutely. And this is incredibly unprecedented. A functioning democracy does not arrest sitting judges for doing their job, not for doing anything criminal or illegal. And they certainly don't, you know, handcuff them and then perp walk them in front of cameras. The goal here clearly is a chilling effect. It's to stop people from, you know, doing their jobs and standing up for community when they are standing up to the Trump regime.
Ryan Clancy is a Wisconsin state representative, member of the Democratic Party, Assembly District 19, which includes part of Milwaukee. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate you.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with author and executive Daria Burke. She'll talk about her new memoir, Of My Own Making, which explores her growing up in 1980s Detroit amid addiction and instability, and the years she spent trying to outrun that past by building a carefully curated, outwardly successful life. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, working to target and destroy cancer-causing proteins with protein degradation. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. DanaFarber.org/everywhere. From FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at FJC.org. From EBSCO, committed to upholding the principles of responsible research as they work to develop AI technologies to enhance research around the world. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The federal government has canceled about $11 billion worth of university research funding and is threatening to cut more. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports that when the federal government stops funding research, there's really no one else to take on those costs.
In the first 3 months of Donald Trump's presidency, dozens of colleges and universities had their federal research grants frozen. Some funds were canceled because of the shuttering of federal departments like USAID and the U.S. Department of Education. Others were halted in response to alleged anti-Semitism on campus. Cancer research, diabetes, research in new wearable technology, farming solutions, early childhood development, and domestic violence. Research across nearly every discipline and subject.
The government-university industry partnership for R&D built the American economy in the 20th century.
Shailen Jotishi is the managing director of the Future of Work and Innovation Economy Initiative at New America, a left-leaning think tank. After World War II, he says the federal government entrusted and deeply invested in universities to conduct research and development.
Everything from the iPhone to GPS technology to fortified vitamin D has had its roots in federally funded research.
In 2021, the federal government gave colleges and universities about $180 billion across dozens of federal agencies, according to the Government Accountability Office, a government watchdog.
American research universities have been the envy of the world for a reason. China and other competitors of the United States are borrowing from the American playbook for innovation.
Jotishi says that the biggest worry is that if the government gets out of this business, there won't be anyone to step in.
Industry cannot and will not pick up the mantle of the public sector in supporting the R&D enterprise.
Sabrina Howell, a finance professor at NYU's business school, studies innovation and university research.
We would not have iPhones if universities like MIT that are federally government funded hadn't worked on lasers.
That laser technology wasn't just used on the iPhone. It helped create semiconductors that essentially power everything we use all day long.
No private company would take on their own, both because it's really expensive. It's not obvious what the commercial application is for all the work that you're doing. And so only government can fund that kind of work.
While the Trump administration talks about handing this work off to the private sector, Howell says it's just too expensive to fund that without a clear return on investment. Her research shows that's because industry has a different motivation on outputs. But there are experts who think changes could be made to this partnership.
It's time for someone to shake things up a bit.
Richard Vedder is a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, a libertarian think tank. He's written about scaling back government funding for research overhead and administration. And while he says Trump's arbitrary cuts aren't what he had in mind, it's definitely sending an important message to colleges.
It's not perhaps the ideal way to change things. It may be a disruptive way to change things. But on the whole, the attempt to reevaluate research grant money is a valid one.
He says maybe now that the public sees the high price tag of federally funded research, there will be a way to make changes or disruptions without abruptly halting essential and life-saving research. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
A new batch of musicians is heading to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, including a major 80s pop star, a groundbreaking Southern rap duo, and a 60s dance icon who spent years lobbying for his own induction. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has the rundown.
There are seven performers who will join the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They joined the 255 artists who are already in the hall, ranging from rock and roll founders like Chuck Berry and Elvis Presley through 21st century artists like Missy Elliott. In recent years, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has expanded the definition of its namesake genre, but it's still letting in straight ahead rock acts like the classic rockers Bad Company.
I can't get enough of your love.
Bad Company has been eligible since 1999, but was nominated for the first time this year. Grunge pioneers Soundgarden are also on the list.
Heat,
so is the legendary Southern rap duo Outkast. Made up of Big Boi and Andre 3000, Outkast put Atlanta on hip-hop's map with albums like AT Aliens, Stankonia, and Speakerbox, The Love Below. This year, they'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So will the rainbow-haired pop star Cyndi Lauper, who rose to stardom on 80s dance floors and on MTV with hits like this one.
If you look, you can look, and you will find it. Time after time.
Also getting inducted is the late English singer Joe Cocker.
Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song.
Cocker became a star in the U.S. with this raspy rendition of the Beatles song With a Little Help from My Friends at Woodstock in 1969. But he went on to release more than 40 albums, spawning hits like Feeling All Right and You Are So Beautiful. Artists are eligible for the Rock Hall 25 years after their first commercial release, and the youngest by that criteria is the White Stripes. The guitar, drums, and vocal duo were at the forefront of the garage rock revival of the early 2000s. The artist who waited the longest for his nomination is Chubby Checker. He danced his way to the very top of the Billboard Hot 100 with this cover of The Twist in 1960. In 2001, Chubby Checker took out a full-page ad in Billboard magazine saying he felt underappreciated for his contributions to rock and roll. He adamantly requested his own induction into the Rock Hall, writing, quote, "I want my flowers while I'm alive. I can't smell them when I'm dead." It's been more than two decades, but the bouquet is finally on its way. Each year, in addition to the inductees named by the Hall's voters, a few musicians are also included as musical influences. This year's honored artists are the groundbreaking female rap group Salt-N-Pepa and the 70s and 80s rock songwriter Warren Zevon. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony will take place on November 8th in Los Angeles. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
It's NPR News.
After college, deaf students are less likely to find jobs in the sciences, healthcare, or teaching, and government grants that aim to change that were just ended by the Trump administration.
I definitely feel like if things had been different, I wouldn't be feeling so lost and unsure about my future.
I'm Ari Shapiro. The uncertainty ahead for students on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump's frustrated Russia and Ukraine are still at war, but White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said today that he is optimistic about a peace deal between Presidents Vladimir Putin of Russia and Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine.
I understand Vladimir Putin this morning offered a temporary ceasefire. The president has made it clear he wants to see a permanent ceasefire first to stop the killing, stop the bloodshed.
Trump and Zelensky met face-to-face over the weekend in St. Peter's Basilica before they attended Pope Francis's funeral. Putin is thanking the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un for providing troops to help Russia fight Ukraine. Hours earlier, Pyongyang admitted for the first time it had deployed soldiers to the conflict. It said it had helped, in its words, to liberate the Russian region of Kursk. A spokesman for South Korea's defense ministry condemned Pyongyang's actions.
North Korea's participation in the war in Ukraine is a clear violation of the UN Charter and Security Council resolutions and constitutes an illegal act. North Korea's official acknowledgement of this involvement is in itself an admission of a criminal act. In response, our military strongly condemns these inhumane and illegal acts, together with the international community.
North Korea's defense ministry spokesperson, Jae On-hak-yu. It's NPR News. President Trump's expected to sign two executive actions on border security today. One targets sanctuary cities, jurisdictions with laws that restrict cooperation with federal immigration authorities. This morning, the White House said raids in recent days in Colorado Springs and Miami led to hundreds of arrests. Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt told reporters the large-scale operations were a preview of actions to come targeting people believed to be in the U.S. illegally. The government is facing a number of lawsuits alleging denial of due process and the deportation of people who have legal status, including U.S. citizenship. In France, the far-right party has another candidate if Marine Le Pen is ineligible to seek the presidency in 2027. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
Jordan Bardella told French newspaper Le Parisien he would run for president if Le Pen cannot. Le Pen, who has run for president three times, was barred from seeking public office for 5 years after a court found her guilty in March of misappropriation of funds. The ruling was a huge blow to the party. Le Pen has appealed. Bardella is a dynamic speaker and extremely popular, especially among young people, but the 29-year-old lacks Le Pen's experience. Polls show Le Pen is by far the leading candidate for the 2027 French presidential race. Term limits prohibit French President Emmanuel Macron from running a third time. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. We're going to spend a few minutes this morning on news from Canada, including the national election happening today. But first, a man in Vancouver has been charged with 8 counts of murder after he drove an SUV into a crowd at a Filipino cultural festival on Saturday night. At least 11 people were killed. Police say it was not a terrorist attack, but there are still plenty of questions about how and why it happened. NPR's Becky Sullivan has this report.
It had been a beautiful spring Saturday afternoon in Vancouver for the city's new annual Lapu-Lapu Day Festival. It was a Filipino street party tied to a holiday in the Philippines that celebrates a historic indigenous victory over Spanish troops back in the 1500s. Saturday's block party in Vancouver had dozens of food trucks and vendors, and thousands of people were in attendance. But by sundown, the scene had turned into a nightmare. Around 8:15 p.m., a man driving a black SUV sped into a crowd of hundreds milling between two rows of food trucks and vendor stalls. Videos circulating on social media showed the chaotic aftermath, with bodies laying on the pavement and bystanders caring for the wounded. Chris Pongilinan was working one of the booths and described what he saw in an interview with the CBC.
It was like seeing a bowling ball hit all the bowling pins and all the pins go flying up in the air. It looked like we were in a war zone.
In addition to the dead, dozens were injured.
This is the darkest day in our city's history.
This is Vancouver's acting police chief Steve Rye speaking to reporters Sunday. The victims' ages ranged from 5 to 65 years old, he said.
There are many unanswered questions about why this horrific crime happened, the motive of the person who did it, and whether anything could have been done to prevent it.
Police identified the driver as 30-year-old Vancouver resident Kai G. Adam Lowe. He was detained by bystanders at the scene, then taken into police custody. City officials, including Mayor Ken Sim, said Sunday they were still trying to figure out the motive.
Evidence points to this not being an act of terrorism. The individual in question has a significant history of mental health issues. He is known to police for a multitude of mental health interactions.
Authorities did not elaborate on the man's previous interactions with police, except to say they were, quote, significant. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Canadians vote today in an election to decide the country's next prime minister. Much of the campaigning has been about which candidate can best handle President Trump. NPR International Affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports from Nova Scotia.
At a recent political rally in the northern Canadian city of Edmonton, thousands of supporters gave a rousing welcome to Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Conservative political party and one of the main candidates in the country's upcoming election. Edmonton is the capital of Alberta, a western prairie province considered to be the Texas of Canada, big on oil and gas and cattle. Here, Poilievre's stand against immigration, big government, and the ruling Liberal Party resonated with supporters like Tegan Reimer.
I'm attending the Pierre rally because I'm sick of the Liberal government for the past 9 years and I want some change.
For months, Poilievre's poll numbers were cresting, while Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's numbers were rock bottom. Poilievre was almost guaranteed a landslide victory in Canada's next election. Almost.
Within an instant, events changed.
David Coletto is founder and CEO of Abacus Data, a Canadian polling firm. He says in January, things started to unravel for Poilievre.
The primary villain was Justin Trudeau. He left. A new villain emerged, bigger, more scary, external to the country in Donald Trump.
Shortly after his inauguration, President Trump started targeting Canada, imposing steep tariffs and threatening its sovereignty.
I think Canada is going to be a very serious contender to be our 51st state.
Trump's taunts and threats outraged many Canadians and led to a rise in nationalism. But Trump's comments also threw a bright spotlight on Poilievre.
Many people in Canada have associated a lot of the language, a lot of the terminology, speaking points that Pierre Poilievre uses to exactly what Donald Trump has been saying.
Robert Hewish is a social science professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
Canada first, migration is a bad thing, stronger borders, budget cuts, all the stuff that you would hear Trump sort of doing, Poilievre has really adapted.
And that association with Trump has hurt Poilievre badly. In January, Poilievre and his Conservative Party were up in the polls, at one point 27 points ahead. But in a stunning turnaround, the Liberals have roared back, and most polls show they're now slightly ahead of the Conservatives. Coletto says Poilievre's setback has benefited Trudeau's successor, Prime Minister Mark Carney.
Mark Carney, the new Liberal leader and Prime Minister, emerged at a moment where I think more and more Canadians were looking for somebody with his experience, with his demeanor, with his approach to politics.
Carney has a financial background on Wall Street, as governor of the Bank of England during the turmoil of Brexit, and as head of the Bank of Canada. But Poilievre says Carney has the same troubled policies as Trudeau. That came up during the election debates, like this one broadcast on global television.
And we're in a new, very different.
So far, Carney seems to have a better relationship with Trump than Trudeau did, and his popularity has helped Liberal candidates across Canada. I met up with Jessica Fancy Landry at a cozy cafe in Lunenburg. She's a first-time candidate running as a Liberal in a small district here in the Maritime Province of Nova Scotia.
People know that this is a historic election. I don't think that there's ever been an election that means more to Canada.
Fancy Landry says voters pepper her with questions about the impact of Trump and his policies on Canada.
Definitely tariffs have been discussed and questioned, and a lot of it is bewilderment.
Jared Wesley, a political scientist at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, says the upcoming Canadian election needs to be about more than just Trump and his policies.
We aren't talking about social policy issues a heck of a lot, and we aren't talking about the environment. Those have been crowded out.
But with a powerful neighbor targeting the country, Canadian voters can't ignore the impact of Trump on the election. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Lunenburg, Nova Scotia.
This afternoon on All Things Considered, what do autistic people think about the way Robert F. Kennedy Jr. describes them? There is a very wide range of autistic people. About a quarter are profoundly affected, and we will hear the leader of the National Council on Severe Autism. Tell your smart speaker to play your local station by name, or listen to the NPR app, or turn on the radio. This is NPR News.
Canadians go to the polls to choose their next prime minister, and Comet Mark Carney leads the race. We will have what's coming next time on Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. Back in August 2020, the LaFleur family boarded up most of the windows to their home in Louisiana to prepare for a hurricane. 2 months later, things were getting back to normal, but one day after work, something was missing. Their six-year-old dog, Kingston. They searched, but finally accepted he was gone. Then last month, they got an email that Kingston had been found at a frat house 300 miles away in Mississippi. When they got there, Kingston ran into their arms, but not before Kappa Sigma made him a member. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Next, we meet some of the people affected by a number in the news.
That number is 884. That is the number of confirmed cases of measles in the United States this year, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So it's April, and we've already tripled the number of cases from last year. Officials also say vaccine hesitancy is a factor in the resurgence.
Measles is in 30 U.S. states now, and we have a view of it this morning in one hard-hit county in Texas. Brad Burt with member station KTTZ went there. Hi there, Brad.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Glad you're with us. Where'd you go?
So I was in Gaines County last week, where a little less than half of all the measles cases in the country have been confirmed, 393 to be exact. What I saw was children playing out at a park in Seminole there, people coming in and out of a coffee shop on Main Street. But meanwhile, the MMR vaccine clinic set up by the South Plains Health District was empty. Zach Holbrooks, director for the district, says vaccine hesitancy has remained an obstacle to ending that outbreak.
It's a lot of groups that are hesitant. So all we can do is provide the venue for people to either get tested, screened, or get the vaccine.
At the beginning of the year, the vaccination rate for this county was 82%. The Centers for Disease Control says at least 95% vaccination rate is needed to prevent outbreaks.
I appreciate that perspective. The vast majority of people in this vaccine-hesitant county are actually not vaccine-hesitant. They've taken the vaccine, but some are not, and that leads to this problem. So what's being done?
Well, local health authorities set up a pop-up clinic in a building where livestock shows are normally held, and billboards and local TV ads encourage people to get vaccinated. There's messaging in English, Spanish, and actually Low German for the local Mennonite community. And yet many here still don't trust vaccines. Pediatrician Dr. Anna Montanez says some parents have chosen to forgo the vaccine for other unproven remedies like vitamin A.
That is our biggest nemesis, right, is misinformation, at least from, you know, healthcare perspective. I struggle with that every single day with almost every patient that I see.
Now, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. previously endorsed vitamin A as a treatment for measles. He has since stepped back from that and is recommended the best treatment as the MMR vaccine.
So you have a longtime vaccine skeptic, maybe the top vaccine skeptic in the country, saying the vaccine is good in this case, but I guess that comes too late for some people. So how has this affected especially children?
Yeah, most of the cases in Texas are children. The two deaths so far in West Texas were children. And you have to ask why that would be. Well, here's an intriguing number. About 18% of students in public schools in this county claim conscientious exemption to required vaccines, and that's provided by state law. Dr. Montanez insists that vaccination is the best prevention, but she says an ounce of protection is worth way more than a pound of cure. She also says when she engages skeptics and answers their questions about alternative remedies like vitamin A, many have become more open to safer decisions. Now, when I was in Seminole, families continued to go about their daily lives. Schools were open, businesses were open, and the virus continues to spread.
Brad Burt with KTTZ in Lubbock, Texas. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
This is NPR News. Thank you. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Women are making a lot of noise in popular music today. Think Beyonce, Taylor Swift, Shania Twain. But when was the last time you heard a piece of classical music composed by a woman? In her new album, French violinist Esther Abrami uncovers what women have had to say musically, from the Middle Ages' Hildegard von Bingen to Miley Cyrus today, dipping into Brazilian dances and, yes, pop along the way. She spoke with me from Paris about what first inspired her.
It's when I came out of university and I was 25 years old that it hit me that in all those years I'd learned hundreds of pieces, but not a single one of them had been written by a woman. Then I started kind of doing my own journey and my own research with it. And it was like opening the door of like a hidden treasure.
Do you think that women have something different to say than men in music?
On my side, what I've kind of found, I think, is that a lot of the music that we have from men is often linked to something like war. You know, heroic music. And I think what you compose is really what you live. And the life of women were very different. So I think the fact that women didn't really have the opportunity to have their pieces performed by full orchestras also mean that a lot of the time they were composing for more intimate ensembles. It's very powerful, but another kind of power.
A number of the composers on this album are names you just don't hear very often, like the Irish composer Ina Boyle. You play her violin concerto. So how did you find them, and then how did you decide to choose them for this album?
The way I found these pieces was really just doing a lot of research, anything I could find, really. I guess I chose those women not only because of their incredible music, but also because of their story.
So that leads me to Vigala, is it, by Ilse Weber?
Yes.
She was Jewish. She was a prisoner at a concentration camp during World War II in what was then a Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. A very powerful story.
Ilse Weber was sent to Theresienstadt's prisoners camp, and she was sent with her and her husband and her son. And she was working as a nurse for the children in the camps. What she was doing was composing music and singing to them. After a while, they decided to send the children to Auschwitz. She took the decision to go to Auschwitz with them. She didn't have to go. And before she left, her husband, who was working as a gardener in this camp, took all of Ilse Weber's music and buried it and hid it. It is known that just before going in the gas chamber, one of the last song lullaby that she sang together with the children was Vigala, this piece that I rearranged and recorded. And after the war, her husband came back and digged out the music, and it's thanks to that that we have this today. We have actual testimony from people who came back from the camps who said how much her singing to the prisoners helped.
So on a happier note, one of the composers on your album, Pauline Viardot, was a, well, I guess we would call her an influencer today in the 19th century. What was her impact on the musical world at the time?
It was huge, and I think that's one important thing to know, is that a lot of women, even though they are completely unknown today, they were very popular during their lifetime. And Pauline was hosting concerts and parties, and all the big figures at the time knew her, and she was very good friend with Georges Sand, Chopin, Robert Schumann, and all these people were coming to play with her, to see her.
I think this is a good place to mention that you too, I understand you don't love the word influencer, but you have an enormous following online, including on TikTok. You know, how did that start? Did it just seem natural to you? It's kind of your people?
Well, it actually came from a point of feeling quite lonely. Being a classical musician means that you spend hours and hours locked in a practice room alone. And that's how I started social media. I enjoy sharing moments of my life as a classical musician that people don't ever see when you just go see classical musician in a concert. And I suddenly have people, you know, who were enjoying viewing these videos, listening to my music. And that really gave me a lot of courage and a lot of motivation also to kind of keep working.
One of the things that you've explored on this album is the difficulty that some of these women had in being heard. You know, you're still in your 20s. Do you still feel that way?
I think the barriers are less obvious. And whilst there's been a huge amount of progress, we are so far off still. That's also a reason why I do social media, is because I see the impact that it has on little girls that come to my concert. They're coming to me saying, oh, I played a piece composed by a woman. So there's still a long way to change things, but I see it changing, and that's beautiful.
That is a violinist, Esther Abrami. Her new album is Women. Esther Abrami, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve.
Willie and Lily were married for years, and Willie was not doing right. Lily would toss and turn, it appears, while Willie slept right through the night. And so she decided to take him away on a romantic cruise South America way. She wanted to make a little hidey-di-di before the fountain of youth ran dry. When she returned and they asked her how was it, this was her reply. Chili was hot and Willie was not. Oh, I was in such a terrible spot. I thought he'd remember those things he forgot. But Chili was hot and Willie was not. The doctor told